So Parkinson's disease is classically considered a brain disorder. Its classic symptoms first described by Dr. James Parkinson on the streets of London in 1817 are tremor, usually at rest, usually in the hands, slowness of movement, and difficulties with walking and balance. And
Professor of Neurology, Ray Dorsey.
Ray Dorsey.
Professor of Neurology, Ray Dorsey.
First of all, in 1817, he described six people with the disease. 200 years later, exactly, the Global Burden of Disease studies estimate that over 6 million people have the disease. So we go from 6 to 6 million. So if you look at the map of Parkinson's disease, areas of the world that are most industrialized, like the US and Canada, have the highest rates of disease. Areas of the world that are least industrialized, like Sub-Saharan Africa, have the lowest rates of disease. If you look at maps in Canada and in France, rates of Parkinson's disease almost correlate perfectly. So nothing in science correlates perfectly, but in this case, almost perfect correlation between rates of pesticide use in agricultural areas in Canada and in France. And these chemicals are associated with a 500% increased risk of Parkinson's disease. I think what we should be spending a lot of time doing, in addition to developing new treatments and new biological markers of disease, we should be spending a lot.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew, if we've not met before. I like to talk health and well-being, motivation, inspiration, and a little bit of science thrown in for good measure. I do so every Monday and Thursday. If you are new, thank you for stopping by. If you're coming back again, thank you indeed. And if you've not already done so, please like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might enjoy this kind of content, and do leave the podcast a positive rating, be it 3, 4, or even 5 stars if you think that you've learned something that merits it. A reminder, I am now on Instagram and on YouTube if you want to check out the videos of these podcast episodes. You can become a subscriber over there too. Now, I am joined by Dr. Ray Dorsey. He is a professor of neurology and the co-author of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease. As you will hear, Dr. Dorsey believes that this dreadful disease is entirely preventable through taking several simple steps. And the case for doing so is becoming more and more pressing, given this disease has exploded in case numbers in only the last 200 years. In this episode, we determine what exactly Parkinson's disease is and how it is not purely a disease of the brain. We hear about Dr. Heiko Brack's hypothesis and the roles that our noses, our guts, and our vagus nerves are playing in the development of Parkinson's. Expect to learn the symptoms of Parkinson's and when exactly they occur. We discover what, according to Dr. Dorsey, is actually causing Parkinson's disease and how we can prevent it. Plus, we discuss diet, exercise, and other measures we can take to mitigate against developing this neurological disease. This is a sobering and fascinating discussion. It will make you angry that more is not being done to address the everyday hazards that are fueling the proliferation of this awful disease.
Well, Dr. Ray Dorsey, co-author of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, you're very welcome to the podcast. We will get to the causes of Parkinson's in a moment, but for the benefit of our listeners and viewers, could you first of all just define exactly how Parkinson's represents or manifests itself in the body?
Thank you very much for having me, Matthew. Delighted to be with you. So Parkinson's disease is classically considered a brain disorder. We'll talk about why that might not be the case. And its classic symptoms first described by Dr. James Parkinson on the streets of London in 1817 are tremor, usually at rest, usually in the hands, slowness of movement, and difficulties with walking and balance. And then a French scientist, Charcot, in 1857, added a fourth characteristic, is stiffness. So tremor, slowness of movement, stiffness, and difficulties with walking and balance are classically the features of Parkinson's disease.
Well, you mentioned Dr. James Parkinson there, the man who discovered this awful illness. And dipping into your book, he referenced six men that he met, six patients that he met, that presented with symptoms from which then he deducted that they had acquired Parkinson's disease. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah. So first of all, in 1817, he described six people with the disease. 200 years later, exactly, the global burden of disease studies estimate that over 6 million people have the disease. So we go from 6 to 6 million in the span of just 200 years, suggesting some dramatic changes in likely our environment to account for that. So he was an experienced guy, 61 years old. He was a surgeon, been practicing medicine for 30 some years. I think he's the son of a physician. And he says, I'm describing something new, something novel, something that's not been classified in the medical literature. He says tremors, long bits is described, and he describes all these other previous, they didn't have the word scientists at the time, but previous physicians who've described tremor. But he said this tremor, this rest tremor, the shuffling gait, the stoop posture, this tendency to walk faster and faster, this is something new. And so, and he only examines three of the patients, three of these individuals. The other three he just sees walking on the streets of London. And so you should ask what's going on in the streets of London in 1817. If you think back in history, this is the height of the Industrial Revolution. Factories in London are spewing out coal and other air pollutants. And the London fog was, you know, very real and was enveloping all of London. It was so polluted that you couldn't even see across the street oftentimes. It was 20 times more polluted than the air in London is today, and twice as polluted as it was in the 1950s when the great smog killed, I think hundreds if not thousands of individuals, led to mass hospitalizations and the first Clean Air Act, at least in the modern world, in London in like 1955.
So your thesis, and you outline this in the book, is that we've gone then from six people presenting with symptoms of Parkinson's 200 years ago to 6 million worldwide. And this has coincided with a rapid increase in the amount of environmental toxins all over the world.
Yeah, so exactly. So if you look at the map of Parkinson's disease, areas of the world that are most industrialized, like the U.S. and Canada, have the highest rates of disease. Areas of the world that are least industrialized, like sub-Saharan Africa, have the lowest rates of the disease. And areas of the world undergoing the most rapid industrialization have the fastest increasing rates of disease. For example, over the last 25 years, the rates of Parkinson's adjusted for age has more than doubled in China. Moreover, if you look at maps in Canada and in France, rates of Parkinson's almost correlate perfectly. So nothing in science correlates perfectly, but in this case, almost perfect correlation between rates of pesticide use in agricultural areas in Canada and in France and rates of Parkinson's disease. So suggesting that numerous environmental toxicants are playing a role in the rise of this disease.
Okay, so we're talking about emissions in the air, we're talking about pesticides, and I believe you mentioned that the dry cleaning industry is also responsible for contributing to this problem.
Yeah, so it's an easy way to think about it. It's in your food, it's in your water, and it's in your air. And so pesticides are obviously in your food and they can get into your water. And then this is a very common dry cleaning chemical. It's called trichloroethylene. It's a simple molecule. Most of your listeners know that water is made up of three atoms, H2O, two hydrogens, and one oxygen. This one's made up of a whopping six atoms, two carbons in black, one hydrogen in white, and then three chlorine atoms in green. And it's got a cousin called perchloroethylene, which just has one additional chlorine atom. And that chemical is still widely used in dry cleaning in the United States. I'm not sure if it's still used in Europe and Australia, but I wouldn't be surprised. And these chemicals are associated with a 500% increased risk of Parkinson's disease. And trichloroethylene, according to the World Health Organization, according to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, is a known carcinogen. So it's causing cancer. And this chemical has been around since the 1920s. So this chemical has been causing cancer, at least according to the EPA and World Health Organization, for 100 years. 100 years of causing cancer, and it's associated with a 500% increased risk of Parkinson's disease.
Okay, so we've already covered quite a bit of ground. Just let me recap on this. So we have a multiplicity of different environmental factors, which you say are contributing to the prevalence, increased prevalence, the exponential increase of prevalence over the last 200 years of Parkinson's disease, which up to now has been considered to be a disease of the brain. Now, I know you're going to show us that is not the case, but what I want to clarify for people also is that The notion historically has been that if you ask people in the street, is Parkinson's disease associated with old age? And people will say yes. This is not the case.
No, so it's definitely associated with old age. So it's like smoking and lung cancer. You smoke a cigarette, you don't get lung cancer the next day. You have to smoke, you have to be exposed to smoking for some period of time. And then there's a lag between the time you smoke and the time you're diagnosed. It takes years for lung cancer to form. It's right, accumulating mutations likely over periods of time and then develop lung cancer. If you look at the incidence of lung cancer, the number of new cases of lung cancer by age, it rises. It triples about every decade beginning in the 40s. So it is Parkinson's disease. Indeed, the incidence curves, the rates of Parkinson's disease as a function of age, mirrors that for lung cancer. So you get exposed to this pesticide or dry cleaning chemical, work with the pesticide today and get Parkinson's disease tomorrow. It's years of exposure and then years for the disease to unfold. And so we know that Parkinson's disease takes years, if not decades, and I wouldn't be surprised if it takes generations for it to unfold. So if everyone died prematurely at age 40, almost no one would get lung cancer and no one would get Parkinson's disease. It takes years for these diseases to unfold, and it likely takes some period of time for people to be exposed, to have sufficient exposure to these toxins for them to develop the disease. So longevity, the passage of time is critical, and likely as we get older, probably for cancer, maybe for Parkinson's disease, and likely for Parkinson's disease, our ability to compensate for these toxicants and the pathology that they've triggered decreases.
Let's talk.
If you get rid of the toxicant, if you get rid of smoking, if you get rid of the pesticide, if you get rid of the dry cleaning chemical, you get rid of the disease, I think. My peers may not agree, but that's the key message, is get rid of the toxicants and then get rid of the disease. Just like the cure for lung cancer isn't, you know, getting your lung taken out. The cure for lung cancer is to stop smoking.
Well, we'll come to more on that in a little bit. But if we can talk about the insidious nature of Parkinson's, because there's an awful lot happening within the body, as you said, for a long period of time. It's like the gestation period, as you said, it can be for generations before Parkinson's is finally diagnosed. So can you talk to us then about the biochemistry and the physiology of what's happening before you get that classic tremor symptom?
So let me give you evidence for that. So in the United States, there's a marine base called Camp Lejeune that was known to be contaminated with this chemical trichloroethylene and its cousin perchloroethylene. And a former NBA basketball player, Brian Grant, was a three-year-old boy when he was stationed at Camp Lejeune. His younger brother nearly dies from health effects likely associated with these chemicals. His father dies of esophageal cancer linked to this chemical. And then when he's 36 in his last year, he's diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, likely even played that season in the NBA, not well, played in season the NBA with Parkinson's disease. So here we have an example of somebody we know was almost certainly exposed to this chemical, whose family members had adverse effects associated with this chemical, and then he develops Parkinson's disease 30-some years later after being exposed at age 3. My colleagues Sam Goldman and Carly Tanner in San Francisco looked at Marines at Camp Lejeune who served there, you know, in their 20s, they were there for 2 years, and then 35 years later, they have a 70% increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. So there's good evidence that this disease takes years to unfold, and there's good evidence that the relevant, or at least one of the relevant exposure periods might have been in early adulthood, 20, or even childhood. Now, so what is actually happening? So we don't know, but I'll give you a hypothesis. So that these toxicants, certain pesticides, dry cleaning chemicals, air pollution, are all known to lead to misfolding of a protein called alpha-synuclein. Some people know that Alzheimer's disease is associated with a protein called amyloid that's misfolded. This is a misfolding of a protein called alpha-synuclein. It is possible that this misfolding begins in the nose or in the gut because these toxicants are either inhaled or they're ingested. You know, think about drinking contaminated well water, and leads to misfolding of this alpha-synuclein protein. This misfolding, we know, can spread from nerve cell to nerve cell, and so that and then spread throughout the entire nervous system. So if you begin in the gut, it can spread up something, a nerve called the vagus nerve that goes all the way from your brain stem, like in your neck, all the way down to your gut. But in this case, this misfolded protein could be traveling from your gut up the vagus nerve, up this highway, to your brain stem and then going to higher and higher parts of your brain before making its way to the part of the brain that's responsible for tremor and slowness of movement. Conversely, you could be inhaling, say, air pollution in 1800 London. You could be inhaling air pollutants, and it could lead to misfolding of proteins in the smell centers of our brain, which we know is one of the most common sites for the misfolded protein, and then spread from the smell center to a part of the brain called the amygdala before it goes to an area of the brain called the substantia nigra, which we know is affected in Parkinson's disease. So it could be that these environmental toxins are entering in through our gut, or we're inhaling them through our nose, and then consequentially spreading eventually to the parts of the brain that are responsible for tremor and slowness of movement.
It's extraordinary, and I think it's worth noting this. It's a big takeaway that Parkinson's disease then seems to start outside of the brain and then affects the brain later on.
Yeah, so Heiko Brock is really, really smart German neuropathologist, in 2003 wrote a paper, and not even one of the top tier journals. He wrote a paper, actually in a supplement to a journal, in which he postulated that Parkinson's disease, heretofore thought of as a disease, doesn't begin the brain. It has its origins outside of the brain. He remarked that the first place that you see pathology in Parkinson's disease isn't in the substantia nigra, which is responsible for tremor and slowness of movement, but you first see it in the smell centers of the brain, olfactory bulb, and you see it in the gut. And then you see it, not in the gut, but in the vagus nerve, which innervates the gut. He thought it might have been due to, it was neuroinvasion. He thought perhaps due to a virus. I don't want to speak too much for him. He's alive. So you can interview Dr. Brock. And he thought it was spreading from the vagus nerve then upwards to the part of the brain that's responsible for tremor and slowness of movement. I think man's a brilliant. He should win a Nobel Prize. I think that's one path. I think it can also then go from the nose backwards to the part of the brain. And there's a great research from other pathologists in Arizona, Chuck Adler and Tom Beach, which have provided evidence for that.
It's really extraordinary. So then, if we're thinking then about classic symptoms that everybody's familiar then with the classic tremor, but what symptoms precede that? And then I know the tremor itself is probably the midway point of symptoms as far as the journey of Parkinson's is concerned. What then follows on then from the classic tremor? So what's before and after that tremor?
Yeah, so what's before is the two of the most common symptoms are constipation and loss of smell.
Wow.
So the two most common, probably even more common than tremor, are constipation, 80% of people, and loss of smell, probably about the same portion. We also know that for some individuals, loss of smell especially precedes the onset of tremor and slowness of movement. And it precedes it by decades. So they've lost their sense of smell long before they develop tremor. And some people develop constipation long before they develop tremor and slowness of movement. So that's what precedes it. What follows it, we'll just take an extreme example. Eventually, people with Parkinson's disease develop significant cognitive impairment, and that's likely as the disease spreads from the substantia nigra to like the outer portions of our brain, the cortex, which is responsible for thinking. So the earliest features of the disease correspond with potential points of entry. The latter portions, latter symptoms of disease correspond with the pathological spread of the disease. So as the pathology spreads from the nose and the gut, you see early constipation, loss of smell. I'm oversimplifying. And then you can see tremor, slowness of movement. These motor features were classically loss of dopamine producing nerve cells in the area of the brain called the substantia nigra. And then late, you see problems with thinking and hallucinations, confusion, as the pathology spreads out to the outer portions of the brain.
I suppose people listening to this will wonder, if they have no symptoms, perhaps they don't even have the constipation or the loss of smell that you're talking about, can they do a test whereby they could find out whether they might be more likely to get Parkinson's later on in life?
So there are people, scientists, developing biological assays, biological measures to see if you can determine it. We have an imaging measure where you image the do a fancy imaging test to look at the dopamine-producing nerve cells in the brain and see if they are reduced. So that's available today. There's a study by my colleague, Dr. Andrew Sidorov, through a study funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation, looking at spinal fluid. And you can see an assay looking at this misfolded alpha-synuclein in the spinal fluid requires a spinal tap. So no one's like jumping to get this done. But for research purposes, to identify people who might be at high risk for developing the disease. And there are some people looking in the skin to see if you can look in the skin and identify this misfolded protein. So there are people looking at early biological measures that could do it. It turns out there could be other measures, imaging or digital or other things that could do it. But those are some of the things that people are looking at.
As of today, can Parkinson's disease be reversed or even halted?
It's preventable, and that we can live in a world where Parkinson's disease is extraordinarily rare, just like I think it was when Dr. Parkinson was describing the condition 200 years ago. By the time someone is diagnosed, you know, with the tremor and the slowness of movement that we discussed at the outset, 60% of those nerve cells in the brain have died off. 60% of those dopamine-producing nerve cells have died off. I think it's really hard to reverse that. I think we do things to slow down the rate of progression of those remaining 40%, including exercise, likely at the top of the list. But I think what we should be spending a lot of time doing, in addition to developing new treatments and new biological markers of disease, is we should be spending a lot of time and effort trying to prevent people from ever getting the disease in the first place. You know, no one in Ireland, no one in the United Kingdom, no one in Australia, no one in the vast majority of parts of the world is worried about polio. None of us are worried about smallpox. None of us are worried about typhus. These are all diseases that used to kill thousands, if not millions, if not billions, in the case of smallpox, people. And we came up with, we identified what the cause of the disease is, and we developed interventions to prevent their spread. If we know what the causes are, even if we're wrong a little bit, but if we know that pesticides, these dry cleaning chemicals and air pollution are likely linked to this disease, and we know they're linked to other diseases, we know these dry cleaning chemicals cause cancer, for example, we get rid of these chemicals. I think we get rid of a ton of Parkinson's disease. I'll give you an example of that. So I told you that, Parkinson's is the world's fastest growing brain disease, but it looks like there are some parts of the world, including Western Europe, where the rates of Parkinson's disease are stabilizing, if not possibly declining, adjusted for age. And in the Netherlands, there was a study that looked at the number of new cases with Parkinson's disease between 1990 and 2010, and it dropped by 60%. Only high-quality study that I'm aware of has shown that the number of new cases of Parkinson's disease adjusted for age has decreased. And then I looked back and I said, well, what happened to pesticide use? What happened to dry cleaning chemicals? And what happened to air pollution? And it turned out that many pesticides, they dissolve in fat. Your brain is fatty. So like pesticides like DDT, some of your listeners will know, can dissolve in fat. So you can actually measure DDT in people's fatty tissues. And in the 1980s or even before, from the 1960s, from 68 to 84, levels of DDT and other fat-soluble pesticides dropped between 75 and 90% in the Netherlands. So a huge decline in a short period of time in the levels of fatty pesticides that have been linked to Parkinson's disease and subsequently linked to a decrease in incidence. Similarly, we looked at dry cleaning chemical, and the rates of this trichloroethylene in the Netherlands in 1981 were among the lowest in all of Europe. And then we looked at air pollution, and one of the great accomplishments in the environment over the last 50 years has been a decline in air pollution, especially in industrialized nations. So air quality in Netherlands is like 50 to 90% cleaner than it once was. Now, this is not the way you ideally do research. You like to follow these risk factors and follow it forward. And I went backwards looking for an answer. So you can say I was biased in my approach. I was looking for a particular answer. But I found evidence that when you drop these intoxicants in the environment, that can be linked to subsequent declines in the rates of Parkinson's.
As a matter of interest, do we see an increase or a higher rates of Parkinson's in the dry cleaning industry and people who work in that sector?
So there's been one study, I think, actually done in Europe that looked at dry cleaners and Parkinson's, and they found they expected to see 0.2 individuals affected with Parkinson's disease. They found 3 individuals with Parkinson's disease, so a 15-fold increase. Small study. But you have to think like how hard the study would be to do. So this is the way you'd have to do this. So one, you would either randomize some dry cleaners to get exposed to this chemical and then randomize other ones to get exposed to a different dry cleaning chemical, follow them for 40 or 50 years and see who developed Parkinson's disease. Hard to do. Other way you do it is you have to go look at dry cleaners and then compare to some comparison group, maybe retail clerks working in a shop and a grocery store, for example, and then follow those people for 30 to 40 years and see what the rates of Parkinson's disease are. Those studies are really, 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 really hard to do. And because even though Parkinson's is relatively common on the grand scheme, all diseases are rare, right? Like there's the vast majority of people don't have any disease. So Parkinson's affects, you know, 1% to 2% of people over 65. So you have to get hundreds, thousands of dry cleaners, have really good history on these dry cleaners and follow them for long periods of time to see what happens. So when you do these studies, there's lots of reasons to not find an association. The biggest reason, you didn't study a large enough population. So when you do find associations, which are really hard to find, when you do find an association, you should pay a lot of attention. Now, anecdotally, you know, my inbox gets flooded with people telling me about their family members who are working in dry cleaners and developing Parkinson's disease and other bad diseases. But I think it's out there and I think it's real. And you don't have to be a dry cleaner. So I'll just say one thing, in New York City, and I presume in Europe, dry cleaners are at the top bottom floor of apartment buildings. And it turns out that you can find these dry cleaning chemicals in the indoor air of apartments in New York City at unsafe levels for people who are just simply living above it. And because these chemicals dissolve in fat, your fat, as we mentioned, is brainy, your brain, as I mentioned, is fatty, is you can find it in the refrigerator, in the butter, and in the cheese.
Well, I'm glad I don't live anywhere near a dry cleaners then after that news. Can I ask you then, in relation to then mitigating against developing Parkinson's, what can we do at the individual level? Now, I know diet comes into this and exercise too. So could you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so there are tons of things. So diet, your Mediterranean diet, I think it's important to think about what's not in your food. So avoiding foods that might have pesticides. So since writing our book, I buy organic. I wash all my produce with a water and a vegetable wash, essentially soap. Because even at least in the United States, organic, I forgot, biological, I think is the term you use in Europe. Produce have pesticide residues, so I wash them. Vigorous exercise, turns out in your 40s, 50s, and 60s, is associated with a 20% decreased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. This consists, vigorous is 3.5 to 4 hours of running or swimming a week. And then I think there are tons of things. So I avoid dry cleaning, and then I use a dry cleaner that doesn't use these chemicals. I told you about buying organic produce. I look for organic cheese, and I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat meat, but I would be paying really attention to animal products because these pesticides get concentrated as they move up the food chain. There was a study showing that cows in Hawaii who were eating the tops of pineapples, the green leafy part tops of pineapples that had the pesticide, that were sprayed with pesticides, they concentrated the pesticide in their milk and then made its way into the stores in Hawaii. And high drinkers of milk in Hawaii developed Parkinson's at higher rates, it appears, than the general population. And they find that pesticide residue in their brain after they die. So I pay a lot of attention to eat. And then I use a water filter, a carbon filter. In the United States, the brand names are Pure and Brita to reduce my exposure to pesticides and toxicants that might be in my water. If I get my water from a well, I'd have it tested. If I live in rural areas, I'd have it tested for pesticides. If I lived in urban areas, I'd have it tested for these dry cleaning chemicals. If I lived in a really polluted area, I would think about having an air purifier in my home, especially like in my bedroom, in my kitchen, to decrease exposure to air pollution. There are studies that link high levels of air pollution to increased risk of hospitalization among people who already have Parkinson's disease. And there's increasing evidence that air pollution is linked to Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So those are just some very practical things. You know, I'd reduce exposure to pesticides in my yard, on my golf course, and the sports fields where my kids play soccer. I'd be thinking about all of these things.
So over and above individual measures that we can take control of ourselves, we're really looking at demanding societal change here.
Yes, and if we change our environment just like we've done it for air pollution. And by the way, we change it for air pollution. In Los Angeles, there are more people driving more cars on the highways in Los Angeles, which are still polluted. More people driving more cars, and our air quality is better, and our economic growth is, and the economy's increased in growth. So you have more cars, more people, higher economic growth, and less air pollution. So this idea that there needs to be a trade-off between economics and environment is completely false. There's little, if any, evidence for that. In fact, that a prerequisite for a healthy, flourishing economy is clean water, clean air, and clean food. If you need any example of that, ask how many people, how much they would have to be paid to go work in Beijing, China, or how much they'd have to be paid to go work in Delhi, India, because of the environmental quality in those areas. Would they want their kids going to school in those areas? I think we can have a flourishing economy throughout the world and a healthy environment by taking practical, pragmatic approaches to decreasing our exposure to toxicants that we know are linked to Parkinson's disease, that we know cause cancer, that we know are linked to a wide range of other health conditions.
So in that case, then, if we partake in these individual measures and control our access and our exposure to these toxicants, as you say, and then if we demand at the same time societal change, this then means then ultimately that Parkinson's disease is a preventable disease. Are you optimistic that we can look back in future generations and think upon Parkinson's disease the same way as we think about smallpox now, for example?
Yeah, so we live in a world where polio is extraordinarily rare. We live in a world where drinking and driving is socially unacceptable. We live in a world where HIV is preventable and treatable. These are all gifts that we've received from previous generations. A March of Dimes in the 1930s changed the course of polio. A Mothers Against Drunk Driving in 1980 changed the course of drinking and driving in the United States and around the world, for that matter. And activists in New York City and San Francisco changed the course of HIV by saying that silence equals death. These are gifts that we've received from previous generations. You have an obligation to receive the gift, and you have an obligation to reciprocate. And I think we have an obligation to create a world where Parkinson's disease is extraordinarily rare or increasingly rare. And I can't think of a better gift as a neurologist. I can't think of a few better gifts that we can do as a society than to give future generations a world where diseases are less common, where people live longer and healthier lives, free of disabling conditions that rob people of their independence and their health.
It's a great message, and I think it's summed up beautifully in your book called Ending Parkinson's Disease, which you co-authored. If people want to find out more about your work and about the book, where can they go, Dr. Dorsey?
They can go to our website, endingpd.org, endingpd.org. They can sign up for our newsletter, free to do so. We put out information. If you live in the U.S., and you can't afford a copy of the book, we send free copies to anyone in the U.S. It's a little bit harder to send it into Europe because of postage rules. But if you live in the U.S., you can email us at info@endingpd.org. We can send you a free copy. If you have a story, if you're a dry cleaner, or if you have information that's contrary to what I've said, I'd like to be educated and informed. You can just email us at info@endingpd.org. And we'd love to hear your stories. And then all the authors of this book are devoting all their proceeds to efforts to prevent and end Parkinson's disease. You can buy the book on Amazon. You can buy the book on a wide range of other platforms. The book is Ending Parkinson's Disease. I think it'd be a great thing for us as our generation is to bring about the end of the very disabling and rapidly growing condition.
I love your mission. I wish you well in your work. And I have to say, I've done almost 400 of these episodes on this podcast, and this is easily one of the most fascinating discussions that I've had. So thank you so much, Dr. Ray Dorsey, for joining me on the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Happy to come back and speak more.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. A reminder to like, subscribe, share, and leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.